I hope you saw what you wanted to see today and are not too exhausted. May I first of all introduce the other members of the panel here who will be answering your questions. On my left is Sir John Cockcroft, whom you all know and needs no introduction. On his left, Dr. Godfrey Stafford, who is the head of the INZ Physics Division here at the Rutherford Laboratory. And on my right, Mr. Leslie Mallett, the Assistant Director of the Rutherford Laboratory. There are other members of the laboratory staff in the theatre with you, and they will be able to help with questions that we may not be able to deal with fully. And so now we have a clear half hour to, perhaps a bit longer if you want to go on longer. The deadline is when people have to leave for the buses. Who would like to start the ball rolling?
Can I ask you for the one I gave lately, Dr.
Yes?
And of course, and future research in the university.
Yes. The total CERN budget, I believe, for 1964, that's for this calendar year, they work on a calendar year as their financial year, is in sterling equivalent £9 million, which of course is shared by the various member states of CERN, including ourselves, and the UK contribution is about a quarter of this, just a little under a quarter now, I believe. So that's something just over £2 million which this country contributes towards the total of nine. A lot of nuclear research, as you know, in universities in this country is supported by DSIR. I don't know exactly what the current figure is there, but it's about £1 million, I think, in a full year. It fluctuates somewhat from time to time because it depends upon the requests which come into the DSIR for support. And in addition, of course, there's an amount which I certainly don't know, couldn't even guess, which the universities contribute from their own resources to the research work which goes on inside the universities.
So when you finish capital expenditure, what will be your annual budget?
Well, I can tell you where we start from, which is this year. I can only guess the future, but as I mentioned this morning, of our 1964-5 anticipated expenditure of just over £6 million, about £1.5 million is the tail end of the capital investment of which you've seen much today. And so certainly already most of our money, say £4.5 million or so, is on the current program. From experience of other laboratories in this field and where we can see ourselves going to, one would expect the expenditure to increase somewhat over the next year or two as the program warms up, and indeed as these things do become more demanding of effort to do a given set of experiments. So as for the total budget, well, we, like other organizations funded by parliamentary votes, we make our estimates once a year, they're submitted once a year. We've just started the financial year, and so we can't even tell you what we're likely to estimate for next year, but I would guess that we'll be estimating a little more than we have this year.
Could you estimate also how many mandates will be put in by outsiders in the work of the establishment here in comparison with the number of permanent staff?
Are you now referring to that part of it which one can separate off as actual use of the machine and performing experiments with it? Or are you talking about total effort deployed around the whole place?
Well, perhaps you could say, in addition, what is the total effort required to keep it going?
Yes. Well, I gave some rough numbers this morning. The number of people who are now starting experiments at Nimrod, or hoping to do so before long when they're ready, And I'm now counting the graduate nuclear physicists, if I could classify them in that way, that is, sort of advanced research students and their staff members associated with them and fellows and so on. Total number of such people is about 150 or so at the moment on Nimrod. And of that number, somewhere around about 20 to 25 perhaps, I think Dr. Stafford would have a better up-to-date number, are our own staff employed by the National Institute. So counting heads, that is the sort of ratio of the giving the breakdown of the use of the output of the accelerator for research as between our own staff and visiting staff belonging to universities.
Yes, the reason I asked you for a mandate was, is there 150 here for a day each?
No, it's not here for a day each, and they're not here all the time. These are people, in most whose cases we know their names, the people who actually exist, who are on the program. Now, the time they spend here is a very variable business. They will, if they're doing a run on the machine, they'll come along with their associates and they will run perhaps day and night for several days, or they may go away again for several weeks and not be seen again, or they may live with us for a long time. This depends upon logistics, upon the way in which the machine is scheduled, upon the obligations in the universities and so on. So it's really extremely difficult to give you a mandate figure. We could do this a little later on when we've been running long enough and can sort of tot up the history of this. I think a more significant figure is the number of people who are basing a significant part of the research on the pledge, you see, because a man might be basing, let us say, the whole of his research temporarily on Nimrod, and he might even so spend only a week or two, in an extreme case, at this laboratory during a year. He's working away at home, preparing apparatus, maybe he's computing data, writing his papers and so forth. He would only be here at times when it was essential or desirable to him for him to be here. And so I'm sorry, I can't give the figure in the simple way that you asked.
I think it's worthwhile saying that some of these visitors are so much part of the laboratory that we can hardly distinguish them from our own staff. This is particularly true of AERE people and some of the university teams who are present running experiments. They're here a great deal of their time.
They are indeed, yes. Again, counting just the leading character, the research people. Eight?
Less than that.
It's a small number, yes. Say half a dozen.
And they, of course, actually do have their offices and their laboratories here with us, and these are the ones, certainly, who could hardly be distinguished from our own staff in every sense.
Is
the
shortage of power likely to
limit
the operation of Nimrod?
The shortage of power? Oh, do you mean because of battery? No, I know what you mean. It's just a little joke. I think you're referring to some publicity which we saw a little while ago. This is a fairly complicated problem to explain, although it's simple enough in reality. Let me go through it. We use a lot of electricity here, for reasons that are obvious to you. When Nimrod is going full bore with a typical set of experimental equipment on it, the total consumption of the laboratory is around 22 megawatts or thereabouts, of which most, of course, is Nimrod. Now, electricity is harder to get in the winter than in the summer. In particular, it is harder to get in the day working week in the winter than it is at night or in the summer. And for this reason, as we all know, the charges are different at these times in cases where one can make a difference. The night storage heaters that we use at home are an example. Now, the tariff which we have here, which is typical of those used in industry, large users of electricity, is made up of a number of components. One is a standing charge which you pay whether you use anything or not, simple enough. The next one is simple enough. It's a charge based on the proportional to the total number of kilowatt hours which are consumed in the period it's being charged for. That's straightforward. The third one is based on the maximum demand, the highest amount, rate of using electricity at any time during those critical times, critical months, the four winter months in the normal working day. If we use electricity during the night at that time of the year, or during any part of the day or night in the rest of the year, it costs us less. To be specific, if we switch on Nimrod with a typical set of beam lines and so forth during the working week in the winter months, this will cost us £150,000, roughly speaking, more than it would if we didn't do so but used it only during the night. So, that if we were in a situation, as we are in now, where we're using Nimrod about half of the time, let's say over many months, we'll have used the machine for half the number of hours that exist in those months, and this is for reasons to do with the fact that it's a new machine and we're learning how to use it and we're still installing things on it, as you've seen, then we would have to decide at some time whether or not to commit 150,000 of the budget which we have to divide up between our various activities to this or not. Clearly this is a sizable sum of money which has to be taken somewhat seriously. But I think that is probably the aspect you wanted me to explain. Does that give you the explanation you wanted?
It's just that, apart from the money question, when we last came down here, I think it was suggested then that the electricity people themselves
had
expressed concern about money demands they would not be able to meet.
Well, I
was wondering whether that position had been improved.
I think perhaps some of my engineering colleagues would be able to answer that one, but of course a load of 20 megawatts is quite something for the local board to consider. And along with other large consumers, we have an arrangement with the electricity board whereby during the difficult times, in the cold weather in the winter, they're in constant touch with us, so that if they're in difficulty and they can see their load rising so they would have to shed it, we have an arrangement whereby they can contact us and say, are you able to reduce your demand a bit to avoid a load shedding? This is a regular standing arrangement we have with them. We've just had a mild winter, and as I recall, we were not asked to cooperate by shedding load this winter. Is one of the engineers could answer that, perhaps.
George. Say to shed load this winter because of our winter on the board just about being managed to meet its demand.
Yes.
But the arrangement is such as Dr. Bigland's described. But if they get the difficulties from this network, then they will contact us and we could voluntarily shed this load.
Is that what you want to know? Yes, thank you.
Could you tell us? I'm not helping this.
Okay, on please.
What Nimrod can do that Desborough won't be able to do, and vice versa?
Yes. Well, two things. One, terribly obvious. There's an enormous premium in this business, of course, for universities to be able to use a machine which is close by. By close by, I mean really close by, so that a man could make up his mind, for example, on a particular day whether to attend some university committee or to see what was going on with his experiment at the place. Now that's obviously a geographical point. It was a point that was considered important by NERMS when we were trying to decide where to put this second laboratory. It was very much in the minds of the governing body of the Institute when Daresbury was in fact chosen. It was chosen not only because it has good subsoil for building machines and so on, but because it's extremely handy for Manchester and Liverpool and the northern universities where there are strong schools of nuclear physics. So that is a real factor. The other factor, a scientific one, Nimrod is a proton accelerator, as you know. It is a machine which is an extremely powerful source of the secondary of the particles, the unstable particles that are generated in nuclear collisions. And as you know, you've heard today anyway, a great deal of the work in this field is connected with the study of those actual particles and one's using the machine as a source of them.
with present machines and present energies which have been achieved, proton machines have always proved much better than electron machines for that kind of thing. And if you look around, you'll find that in most cases where a choice had to be made between one machine and another, the choice has been for a proton machine. There are more proton machines about in this energy range than electron machines. However, there are some phenomena in high energy physics which are important, which cannot be studied with a proton machine. For example, a study of the production processes of these particles where electromagnetic radiation is interacting with nucleons, particles in the nucleus, to produce the strange particles, the other so-called elementary particles. Clearly, one wants a source of quanta to do this. It's a field which is theoretically interesting and part of the whole picture. It has been in the past somewhat more amenable to theoretical treatment than the production by protons or heavy particles. And so that is a specific reason for preferring electrons to protons for the second machine. When we were building the first machine, there was a lot of argument, and for reasons I've just mentioned, we chose a proton machine. The second machine, when we feel it can be justified, there's this extra argument in favor of electrons because we haven't got them here. There's another field of work, quite important, which can be done with the Darsby machine, which Nimrod will not be able to do at all, and that is a study of the structure of the nucleons themselves by bombarding them with other particles which do not interact with nucleons, so that you can just look at the distribution in crude terms of the electric charge inside the nucleon. One can use the electron beam from the Darsby machine for this work, and that's those two things, photoproduction processes and study of nucleonic structure by electron bombardment, were the two main fields that the physicists had in mind when the Darsby machine was chosen to be of that type.
As for Nimrod itself, is there any specific life span given to it?
Yes, well, we always like to guess this, not only for our edification, these things have cost a lot of time and money. There are two lives you can talk about. One is, for how long is this thing likely to be viable as an engineering entity? You know, its reliability, and when will it sort of fall apart? The other is, when, remembering that there's a lot of work involved in using it, and a lot of expense therefore, for how long will it remain a frontline tool of research? For how long will it be worthwhile to use it? I think that in the present state of physics, there's every justification of believing that the useful life of the machine as a research tool will in fact be as long as its life as an engineering object. By that, in terms of years, I would say one can look forward to 15 years, I hope 15 years plus, of life from a machine like this. If the past is any guide, except for some rather small machines in rather specialized fields, it's been rather rare for an accelerator to be scrapped after as little as 15 years operation.
Taking it that the experiments being conducted by Nimrod would be successful, could we take it that larger and greater potential accelerators are envisaged later, at a later date? So
yeah.
Those like with CERN, those being built, or it has been built in
Yes, well, of course, it's part of the job of people working in this field of physics to look ahead to what the needs are likely to be, particularly as it takes such a long time to produce the equipment, and so we do think about these things. Nowadays, of course, it's necessary to think broadly about them. The attack on these problems in physics is becoming increasingly international, and we should look at the problem from the point of view of the needs of our own researchers in this country, at the universities in particular, on the one hand, and on the other hand, guide our own domestic program in consultation with others in other countries, so that the whole European picture remains a balanced one. It looks pretty well balanced right now. We have the very big machine in CERN, which people from this and other countries can use. There's the Nimrod here now, there's a machine somewhat smaller than Nimrod in Saclay, there's an electron machine in Hamburg. One should look at all these things and think of a European program, even though the decisions are taken individually in the various countries. My own belief, I'm now speaking as a physicist, a person generally, not as director of this laboratory or someone to do with NERNS, is that the next major step would be a really large machine in the European context, the one that, as you know, has been under discussion in Europe for some time. And I would feel that for this country's own, as it were, domestic program, we should wait before really taking a particular line on what the next step is until we see the fate of that proposal. I think this would very much affect what we would do here, because we hoped, obviously, to use that machine. And having been provided with Nimrod, which is just starting now, and Nina in Darsbury, which will start in a couple of years, if a big international project goes ahead, I would think it would be quite some time before we would need to start another machine in this country. That's my own view.
Dr. Pickermans, one often gathers that almost, if not all, of the experiments here are designed for the study of the properties of specific particles. And in the course of these studies, it's possible, again, that new particles may be revealed.
Yes.
But is any program in hand or designed, specifically designed to reveal the existence of new particles so far not identified?
On the program that you've seen, which is just starting, no, not specifically to discover a new particle, although, as you have said, these things are often discovered while some other experiments are being done. In fact, this has been rather usual. But there has been some thought given, perhaps Dr. Stafford would like to enlarge upon this, to specific experiments of this nature, which are in rather a formative stage at the moment. Is there anything you'd like to wish to add, Rolf?
I don't think so, that one can add very much at this stage. The experimental program we've got at the moment has taken into account that we're starting with a brand new machine and we've got to learn how to use it, so we have selected what we believe to be very worthwhile experiments, some which we're pretty sure will pay off. Now, if you start looking for new particles, it always sounds very exciting to have discovered something new, but there's always a lot of uncertainty about it. However, with the interest that is being developed at the moment in unitary symmetry, which has hit the headlines quite recently, it's fairly obvious that one will be looking at the predictions made by this theory and seeing what we can do about it. And it would be rather surprising if, in fact, within the next year or so, that an experiment of this sort wasn't launched. In fact, while I've been talking, I've just realized that last Monday we had a talk given in this laboratory about a proposal for an experiment by a man from Birmingham University who will be working in collaboration with people from this laboratory and from Cambridge University. And this in itself, when this experiment is done, it is quite likely that it will show evidence for some of these new particles.
Well, then can I ask just a supplementary to that, Doctor? Originally it was thought there were only three or four basic particles. We now know there are well over 100.
Mm-hmm.
What is your feeling about how far on we are? I mean, is it likely that there will be hundreds, or that there may be 150, or we don't
Well, this is I think perhaps the answer to this one is that one's not quite sure in this context what one means by a fundamental particle. And in fact, if you look at nature as it's revealed for the moment, it looks very, really terribly complicated. And one believes, on the basis of what has happened in atomic physics in the past, that this is probably, appears to be very complicated, just because of the moment of our lack of understanding of the problems, and that when one and gets a greater understanding, that it will appear to be much simpler, and that these are just ramifications of sort of rather more simpler processes. I think that's what one might hope. It certainly it would be surprising if, in fact, we had reached the end of the road in discovering what are now called new particles. I should think there are quite a large number of these particles which still remain to be discovered.
I think one could throw in a further comment. I think that's probably true. We find more and more of these things. We're very rash to say that we wouldn't after what's happened in the last 5 years. But, you know, how many of these particles really are as elementary as a particle like a proton or an electron? I mean, most of these 100 are not. They are collections of other particles that we knew before in some way, because they break up into them when they disintegrate. Or they are, as it were, excited states, just as you can get an atom existing in various forms. So one can already see that some of these particles are, as it were, more respectable than others. But with that proviso, it's quite probable that more and more of these subatomic objects will be discovered.
Could I develop this line of questioning in a slightly different way? It seems to me if Nimrod was to qualify the bona fide front line machine as opposed to being just behind the front line, you must be able to think of front line questions which it could answer in principle. And you know, I understand that the sort of real frontline questions are mostly in higher resonances, which in principle are only reachable at very high energies. What sort of genuinely frontline questions are within reach of you, and if so, are they intelligible to us?
Yes, I don't really think that's true. I think that we can observe at least the majority of all the resonances that exist.
Genuine.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are one or two that it would be rash to try and do on this.
Could you find an omega minus?
That would be right.
That's a bit difficult.
That's the point which one would really require rather. Well, one could probably get the energy, but the intensity of that level would be so low that it may not be worthwhile doing.
I think
the field is so incredibly rich in this line of investigation that this matters very little. When one looks into it, one has really only started scratching the surface of this type of research, and so there is enormous amount of physics that one can do. Let me give you another example of this. One thing that has been very exciting in the last few years at CERN and at Brookhaven has been the discovery of two sorts of neutrinos. Now, it is certainly true that the two machines that are very well suited for that purpose are these very high energy machines, because when you have the 30 GeV that is available, you can get the high energy neutrinos. But it has in fact been shown by some Bristol physicists that in fact, apart from the need for the highest energy neutrinos, machines in this energy region are very well suited for that type of research. A machine very similar to ours that has just started working in the United States, the Argonne National Laboratory, slightly higher in energy, but they are putting a lot of effort into the neutrino experiments. But I don't think it's a particularly serious drawback.
There are two sorts of front line, you see. One is a very easily defined one. What happens at a higher energy than we've got, you see? And you make that and you find out. And something always does. But many of the greatest discoveries have been made in a region which has been accessible for some time. And the real point is that some bright spark has been on the spot at the right time and said, now that is, here is what's happening in this experiment.
Can we now find questions? I mean, $64,000 $4 million question, from which you started. If so, are you the sort of experiments we need to bring on? I don't know what the next big experiments are.
I don't know that I'm about to define that particular question. There's so many experiments which are obviously necessary at the moment. But I would